Don, what do you remember about Gus Sewer?
Gus Sewer, he was really a good ball player for Pittsburgh. He was, if I'm not mistaken, Gus Sewer was one of the right-hand hitters. First baseman, they used it, and that was unusual because I was using left-hand hitters first baseman. But Gus was a good part of that, a big, important part of the Pittsburgh Pirates because he was a good fielder. And Archie Vaughn. And he wasn't too good of a thrower. And Sewer really, really helped him. And I think Sewer was, he was kind of a base for the club. You know, the rest of them, of course, they had the Wieners, and they had Archie, and they had Wiener at that time. Paul, Brian Trainer, I meant,
yeah.
At that time. And then Bill Brubaker came along. But I think Gus was kind of an anchor for that whole club. He always, the rest of it was just there, but Gus was there when you needed him. He drove in the good runs for you. And I think Gus was really probably more that. There's a lot of fellows that play good ball that really don't get the credit that they should get. But the other ball players could see what he's doing. If you're on the other club, or you watch him, because you have a little bit different insight. I think Gus was that type of ball player.
How about Billy Jurgis or Billy Jurgis?
Jurgis, yeah, Billy Jurgis. He was, like I said a while ago, he was a shortstop with he and Billy Herman. They're probably the best double play combination at that time. And he was a good fielder. He had good range. He could go sideways very, very well. They had a good arm. They got a good accurate arm. And I think that. He never was a good, outstanding hitter. I think that's probably why he didn't get as much publicity as the rest of them, because he played with guys that could really hit, like Gabby Hart and Bill and good like that, that were great hitters, and they kind of overshadowed him. But he was a good defensive, good defensive. I liked Billy. Later on, Billy and I quit playing. He was a scout for Washington, I think it was, anyway. And we used to see each other down in instruction in Sarasota, Florida. And we used to talk a lot. He was a very good. He was a good baseball man. He helped a lot of infielders. He could teach. He knew how to teach.
And the last one I want to ask you about is your buddy Ellis Clary.
Oh my Lord, Ellis Clary! I think you could write books about him. He is one of the funniest men I've ever seen. Ellis is good on any club. Not only as a player, he was a good player too. But to keep the morale up. I'll tell you a story about Ellis. The last day of the World Series, last day of the 1944 American League pennant race, we were tied for the pennant. We had to win, and Detroit had to get beat. And so Ellis was there, and he was a great, he loved football, he loved to bet on football. And so he sneaked a radio down in the dugout, and when Sewell would go out to coach in every half inning, we were bad, he would turn on the radio and listen to the Chicago team play.
Chicago Bears?
Bears, and somebody else, who I forget who was playing that day, but I know the Bears were playing, and I think he was, and he'd say, hey, the Bears are ahead, this went for 20-yard gain, you know. All the, here we were trying to win the American League pennant, and he would tell us about the up there in the back. He kept all of it free and easy. You know?
Uh-huh.
And he did a lot. Ellis can tell you, he's the best storyteller. He's the best storyteller, and he can remember those things. Like, I don't know how he remembers such many things he remembers, but he does. And he's a funny, funny man. He's one of my favorite people. I tell you, I laugh at him. But I just look at Ellis Clary and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
He just cracks me up.
You still keep in touch with him or no?
Well, yeah. We was up in St. Louis not too long ago
for the 50th anniversary of the Browns.
50th anniversary of the Browns. We're going back to, by the way, in May, and he was great. He everybody loved Clary. He's one of those guys. Just if he's around, everybody just pays attention to him. He just attracts attention.
All right, we're going to go more American League now.
Okay.
I want to talk about Rudy York. I can't remember somebody. Called Rudy York, they said he was half Indian, half first baseman. I can't remember who called him that, but what do you remember about him?
When you read him. Okay, Rudy York, I played with him, of course, in Boston. And first, of course, I played against him when he was with Detroit. And he was a power hitter. That Detroit ballpark was just made for him. And I think at one time, he set a record, I think one time, he had 17 home runs in the first month of the season or something like that. Anyway, he was a powerful hitter. But like I said, he wasn't a very good fielder, I'll put it that way. And so he couldn't play first base very well, but he could sure hit. And he could hit with men on base, too. Of course, that's when I saw him first was in Detroit. And then he and Greenberg had played outfield. So York could play first base.
Right.
I think it did. So York had probably got hurt out in the outfield. But anyway, they York, and then he played, and then played with him, and when I joined the Red Sox, he was with the Red Sox in 1946, and he was really a big part of that Red Sox, I'll tell you, because he hit after Ted Williams, and they almost had to pitch to Ted in order to get, you know, because York would drive him in if he didn't, and I think York, he probably did as much to win the pennant for Red Sox as Ted Williams did, really, in my opinion, because in the World Series too, he had a couple home runs in the World Series in 46. He was good. And one little story, about him. One time he was on second base. He wasn't known to be a good base runner, but somebody hit a high pop fly to infield. Well, he took out. There's only one out. He took out. Went around third base and went to home base, and the guy dropped the ball. And he said, "Well, I knew he was going to drop it." But he was that kind of a base runner too. So you get the idea, don't you? Yeah, he was. But that really was very. He was a good team man too. Another thing too that he did, he said that he led the league in setting hotels on fire. You know, he liked to drink a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had a little more than he could. Then he'd go to sleep with a cigarette, and he set four or five hotels on fire during that year. And they said that nobody wanted a room with him because he said he led the league in setting hotels on fire.
Was Paul Dean with the Browns when you were with the Browns?
Yeah, just that he just came.
43.
43, yeah, I think it was. And he just came for a short time because he couldn't. I mean, he thought he could throw, but he couldn't.
He
didn't last. I don't think he, if I'm not mistaken, I don't think he played more than three or four ball games.
Uh-huh.
it just kind of getting rid of it.
How about Bobo Newsom?
Oh, Bobo. He played with every club in the whole league. Didn't
yeah, twice, I think.
Twice.
He wouldn't tie his own shoes on the day that he was supposed to pitch. Do you remember that? I read that somewhere.
No, I didn't know.
The day he was supposed to pitch, he wouldn't tie his shoes. He would stand around until somebody came over and
tie his shoes.
Yeah, with one of his superstitions. Do you remember that?
But I know, but one of his superstitions too was that, you know, if there's anything on the mound, he'd pick up little paper things off the mound. And I remember a couple of our players when we were playing against him coming into the outfield and paper come across the mound, just dropped a piece of paper on the mound before he pitched.
He had to pick
them all up. Bobo was kind of one of a kind too, wasn't he? He played with every team, I think, in both leagues twice, as you said. But he's a pretty good pitcher. He had that big wind up, that big whirlwind windmill wind up. He was a pretty good pitcher one time. He kind of outlived his usefulness before he quit. Quit a little before he did.
And he got his nickname from calling everybody else Bobo, is that right?
I think so. Yeah. I didn't know him at that time, but when I knew him, he was Bobo. So I heard that same story that he called, "Hey Bobo, hey Bo, hey Bo." So, and he was on club with us, he called him, "Hey Bo," you know. He still did that.
Well, from what I read, that he was on the teams for such a short period of time, he never got to learn anybody's names anyway.
Maybe that's it. Now that's a good idea.
How about George McQuinn?
George McQuinn is probably one of the best fielding first basemen that I ever played for. Played with. I mean, I'll tell you one thing, when you're playing infield with George McQuinn, all you had to do is just start the ball in that direction somewhere, and he'd come up with it somewhere. He was a good fielder. He really was. And he was a pretty good hitter, too. He came up at the wrong time. He was the wrong place at the wrong time. He could have probably played with the Yankees if Lou Gehrig hadn't been there. Uh-huh. Because he'd go up every year and have a good year in AAA, and well, who's going to beat Lou Gehrig out of the job? So they'd send him back. And finally, of course, they had to get rid of him because the baseball rules said that, and the Browns were lucky enough to get him. And he was a good fielder. I'll tell you, he saved me a lot of errors, I know. Because I could start a ball in that direction, and he'd come up with something. Mm-hmm.
And the other, you played second base with the Browns.
Yes, second.
And shortstop was Vern Stevens.
Vern Stevens.
And he came up. He was starting at the age of 21, I think.
Yeah. He was. He and I came together in 41. He was he had been with San Antonio. They had brought him up through their system. He's probably one of the strongest men, physically strong, of any ball players I know. He was just strong, you know. And he didn't take too good care of himself. He could play shortstop, had a good arm. But he was a little bit wild in his throwing. I mean, he couldn't. That's where McQuinn came in. Helped him. But he didn't have real good range, you know. I mean, he couldn't go very far, but if he got to the ball, he'd catch it. I mean, he had good hands if he got to it. And his arm was just a little on the, well, a little wild side, you say. Not too bad. But he was a good ball player. He could drive in runs. He was another one, kind of a midweek type hitter, really. He had a lot of bad balls. Four, too. He had the power. It's a shame that I roomed with him for 1 year. I said I didn't room with him. I just roomed with his suitcase.
He was always out.
He had a good time. You know, he loved. He played hard in the daytime. Played just as hard at night. But he was a good ball player.
Now he jumped to the Mexican League, but then they brought him back in time. Did you have any offers to go to the Mexican League at that point?
No, I did not. No, I did not have any offers. But talk about bringing them back across the border. I was at that time, then that was in 46, wasn't it? And I was managing Toledo. Brown had sent me over to Toledo to manage Toledo the first part of the year.
Right.
And so we trained in San Antonio. And so they was talking to him. One of the scouts sneaked across there, over there and found out about it and brought him back across the border because he had bodyguards around him all the time. And so I don't know exactly how he did it. Jack Fournier was the guy that went over there and got him in a car, or got him up to there, and then put him in a car right quick and run him across the border and brought him to San Antonio. And so he came to San Antonio. That's where he landed when he came across there. And of course, I being his roommate, mm-hmm. he came there and I talked to him. He said, no, that was, he was talking about how horrible. He said, well, he couldn't do nothing. You know, the guys were with him all the time, constant bodyguards,
mm-hmm.
because he got that money and he didn't want, who was it? Pasquale didn't want to lose that money.
He wanted anything bad to happen to him.
Yeah, they don't have it. He came across the border, and at that time, and then I think he went back to the Browns. I think they sold him to the Red Sox after 47 or 48 or something. Sometime, I think.
Yeah, because I know that Beck was ready to trade Boudreaux for Stevens at one point.
Yeah.
And I guess the word of the trade broke before it was actually deal was made, and the Cleveland fans went bananas.
Yeah.
In fact, didn't get rid of Boudreaux, and of course, I guess it was either that year or the following year that the Indians won a World Series. So.
Yeah, that you're right.
But some of the guys that went to the Mexican League weren't so lucky. I think Max Lanier, I think was one of them.
Yeah, Max Lanier stayed out there a year and a half, didn't he?
Yeah. And then these guys were, first they were banned permanently, I guess, and then a lot of them just wound up with 5 years.
And
suspension.
Mickey Owens is another one.
Mickey Owens, another one you played with? Yeah.
Yeah. Mickey, because I remember, of course, I came up from the Cardinal organization with Mickey.
Oh.
And so I knew Mickey too, and Mickey, he'll tell you some stories too. He finally got, just a year or two that they'd take his band away from him, let him play back with him.
Yeah, a couple of them. I think it went from lifetime bans to 5 year bans, and then some of them did stay out the full 5 years, but other guys got back in after 1, 2, 3 years, something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Yeah, by the way, he lived over in Springfield. You ought to talk to him. He'd give you some talk. In fact, the matter, he talked from morning to night. He talks about anything, everything. He just talks.
We talked about this guy a little bit before, the last time we were here, too. A guy that really helped the Browns out in 44 was Sig Jakuki.
Oh, Sig. Sig Jakuki. Sig was a Marine that was discharged from the Marines. He had been in the Marines and discharged before. He discharged from 43 or 42 or 3, something back in there. Because he had served he'd served two different hitches in the Marines. And he was, when they saw him, but somebody saw him down in the Galveston, Texas, pitching for a Simicro team. And said he could pitch. And besides that, he could play there all year because he wouldn't go back into service. He'd served his time. And so they signed him and brought him up there. And he was, he and the bottle got along very well.
Yeah, I guess he's a big drinker,
good drinker, and they knew that. I mean, they said they got accepted, you know. So they brought him up, and he proved to be a big. He could throw hard and he could throw strikes. And that he could throw hard and he could throw strikes. You that especially at that time you could win, and he won for us. And they said. One time I talked about Quinn, always kidded. Quinn was, he was kind of a quiet guy. He didn't say very many funny things. So one time he pitched on a Wednesday. And he started out of the clubhouse that night. And Quinn said, well, I'll see you Saturday. So sometimes he'd be timed, he wouldn't show up. And we accepted that. Because we knew that from the beginning, and we said, well, if he can win for us, what do we care what he does other time?
Yeah.
He doesn't hurt the club because he's not an everyday player. But when he wanted to pitch, he pitched. It didn't keep him from pitching. and he would pitch and pitch hard, and he was a good competitor. He would fight you. Of course, he that Marine, that bulldog in him, and he was the one that he pitched our last game of the season. He was the guy that you just didn't have on the mound as anybody else when it came down to really, really doing the job. He did have that habit, of drinking. And he just never could get out of it. And everybody knew it, accepted it, and it still kind of hurt you to think, you know, how good could he have been if he just would have done that. And everybody has their own personality.
Yeah, I guess he dragged himself out of baseball, I guess, the following year then.
Yeah, he did, yeah. He was a little older than he was just getting. He had a little bit of money, and you know, he made a little bit of money. He probably spent it before the season was over. What would they tell about him? We won the pennant in 1944. We won the pennant, and the game was over about 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. And Tom Barnes, our owner, said, "Now at 6 o'clock, everybody come up to the Chase Hotel, and I've got the top floor, and it's yours. Anything, everything is free. You eat, drink, anything you want to do. Stay there as long as you want to. Get some parties on you. Just have a big time. Just come up there." Well, we all straggled in there about, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock. Pretty soon, in comes Tsukuki, and he had already had his bottle going, and he was loading. He said, "I'm just made with money," and he had money. He had dollar bills, and he stuck them in his ears, buttonholes, in his cuff links, and he stood up. "I'm made of money. I'm in the World Series." And they found him 2 days later over in East St. Louis, and he didn't have it. Dirty, filthy, didn't know where his clothes was. I mean, no.
So this is in between the end of the season and the beginning of the World Series. They found him.
No, after the World Series.
Oh, this is after the World Series.
They told him one time before the last game of the season, and they said, "Now, Tsukuki, don't you drink tonight, because you're going to pitch tomorrow," and it's a good game. "Okay," he said, "I won't drink tonight." And he sent Zach Taylor, who's staying in the same hotel over there, and so they said, Zach, you look after him. And so about 11 o'clock, Zach, he went up to his room. He came to school, came to park in the next day, smelling like a brewer.
Like a distillery.
And he said, he said, "I told you not to drink." He said, "I didn't drink last night." He said, "I drank this morning."
And he won the game.
He won the game. When he went out to the pitch, he really pitched. I mean, there was no foolishness about it. He was competitive.
It wasn't much of a role model.
He wasn't a role pitcher. No, that's all fair.
Did you and Bill Zuber play on the same team?
Bill Zuber and I played on the same team in 1946 with the Boston Red Sox. And Bill Zuber, he was another one. He was from Iowa, Mennonite.
Yeah.
And of course, he told me one time that they had a terrible time when he left because they didn't want him to leave because. Then he had to give his salary back to the
community.
And, but he got, somehow they gave him a dispensation that he could keep so much to live on. Or I don't know exactly how it was, but he told me that one time. And he was a funny, he was a big old German boy. That, he said, "Bill Zuba." He said, "My name is Bill Zuba." And I laughed at him. He was a funny hero. He did funny things, not intentional. Everything he did was just funny. He told me one time he was pitching for the Yankees, and he was scared to death of McCarthy. I don't know. He said he just scared me to death. He said I see the man now and I start shaking. Just see him on the street or anything else. And he said one time I was pitching, and he said we was pitching in the middle of the ball game, and I got up, and he said the inning was over, and I went out to the mound. And he said, "I got out of the mound, and I found out I forgot my glove." And he said, "Who was the one man in the whole they didn't notice that I didn't have a glove on, McCarthy. And he said that he came back to get his glove, and McCarthy just said, he said, of all the people, the first one was Bill McCarthy. He said, look down. Bill McCarthy looked at him, just looking right straight at him. And there his glove was laying right beside him. Things like that happened to Bill. Mm-hmm. But he died. He terrible. Kind of died, kind of hard death. He had real problem with his feet. I don't know if it was cancer or something, but his feet swelled. And I don't know what it was. It finally killed him. He ran a restaurant up in right out of Cedar Rapids, just a little bit. And he and his wife, I think his wife probably still runs the restaurant.
The restaurant is still open.
Well, they serve good food there, too, I'll tell you. I didn't buy there when he was there. One time I went in there. He didn't know I was scouting. He didn't know I was in, of course. And so we went and ordered steak. He came out of my place. And I said, very loud voice, I said, go tell that chef back there that there's a terrible steak. We all hope he has to eat it himself. Oh, I just give him help. And he came out of that, he was in the back. And like, you see, but that, oh, he's just got he really got to give me a cussing. He knew what it was. Then he brought out a whole, he went back and got a whole bunch of, it was four of us. He got four or five more steaks, put them on the table. He said, eat till you get, he was a good old boy.
Because yeah, they're selling they have a book out about them now. And
they, oh, do they?
Yeah, there's it's paperback there.
I'm going to get that book. I want that book. He's a character.
Another guy, probably in the same vein, I guess, is Lefty Gomez. How well did you know him?
I didn't know Lefty Gomez except again. I pitched against. He was with the Yankees when I was with the Black first, and I didn't know him then, but I know he's kind of a goofy guy, fun guy. And then I know him several times because I've met him at different times at least speaking engagements and things and at reunions. And I laughed at him. I think he always called me poor man Cesar Romero. he said, here comes the poor man Cesar Romero. And he said, hey, he said, take that coat hanger out of your coat. You know, I had square shoulders. Mm-hmm. You're the only guy I know that wears a coat hanger when he would put on his coat.
Let me pick another one here. How about, when you were at the Browns in 44 and 45, when Neuhauser won the back-to-back MVPs, how good a pitcher was he?
He was a good pitcher, yes. He was, he and Dizzy Trout were, well, they were the mainstays. They were the whole staff, really. And Neuhauser was a real, he was a good pitcher. He wouldn't have been that good. It hadn't been a war yet, but he would have been, you know, because he was that good, whether it was the war years or whatever. I think Neuhauser would have been a great pitcher in any era, because he knew how to pitch. He was a good lanky kid. He had a real good loose arm. He could pitch. So could Dizzy Trout, too. They could go. They could pitch.
Let me pick another one here. Well, you talked about Bill Dickey before.
Yeah.
I don't know if he, was he still playing when you?
No. I played against him. Yes. And then I knew him better when he came back to be his coach at the Yankees when I knew him. Yeah, that's not I played against him way back in spring training thing, but I didn't play against him until where I saw most of the time was when he was the coach of the Yankees, and I admired him very much. He was a very student of the game. I liked him. I thought he was a very solid citizen. He was a smart guy too. Yogi Berra became a great catcher. Mm-hmm. He brought him back to teach Yogi how to catch. And he did. He kept after Yogi. Took a little doing to get Yogi settled out into that thing. Yogi's quite a character too. I laugh at him. He does funny things, but he laugh at him, But he's one of the smartest guys that you ever want. Really. He's not a dumb character. He like Dizzy Dean, dumb like a fox. Mm-hmm. He laughs all the way to the bank. By the way, I saw him yesterday at the golf tournament in Pebble Beach.
Mm-hmm.
He was playing with golfing. He hit a good shot. So it's,
Yogi, huh?
Yogi.
How mean a pitcher was Early Wynn?
He was mean. Early Wynn was kind of what we call, well, Rance Rickey used to call Caterpillar Hero the backdoor pitcher. He would always try to get you, the first two or three pitches, he wouldn't throw a strike. He tried to get you to nibble and get a ball that you shouldn't have hit, you know, not hit yet. And then he would come back and throw strikes. He just worried a manager to death because he's always behind in the count. He's always behind 3-0, 3-1. But he's always just like that. That's the way he pitched. Mm-hmm. But he would knock you down. Yeah. Yeah. He would. Don't think he would. He would come to error in the error that, you know, you push people back. I don't mean he killed you. I don't mean he hits your head, but he sure wouldn't let you stand over the plate. That plate is mine as well as yours, and I'm going to take my part of it. He and Burley Grimes, pitchers like that, old Burley Grimes, Charlie Root, and Drysdale, and guys like that. They're just mean pitchers because they don't let you get set in that mound. They're tough hit because they don't let you get up and get set where you want to get set. You set where they want you to set. And early was a good. He was a good competitor.
Well, you played against him.
Played with him. He was with a. He was with a White.
Well.
Oh yes, I played against him one time. Yeah. Then.
Yeah, and I know when you're coaching White Sox, he was with the White Sox in the late '50s.
He was in the 59 World Series. He started two games in the World Series. He won one and lost the other in the World Series. But yeah, he was a good pitcher. You know, Cleveland had a pretty good pitching staff, and they would have Garcia, Wynn, Feller, and Lemon,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Score. What pitcher they had over there? He would. We didn't like to go in there if he scored a run. Then you score, you keep them from scoring a run, you score a run, you win. Otherwise, if they score two runs on you, you're done.
Well, being from Cleveland, I wish they would have won more, but
yeah,
it didn't work out that way. Was DiMaggio the most graceful ball player you ever saw?
Probably is. He and Charlie Gehringer. I thought Charlie Gehringer was one of the smoothest players I ever saw. And so did DiMaggio. DiMaggio didn't look like he's ever going to catch a ball. Ball away from him. And he'd just glide over there like he couldn't catch it. And Gehringer, second baseman of Detroit, he was the same way. He just got to glide over and catch
the ball. Well, they called him the mechanical man, I think.
He just everything. You know, just did everything so good that he didn't look like he was really putting on any effort, but he always did it. That was it. That's a shame. guys like that. he was great.
How fast a runner was George Case?
He could run. Of course, he was very fast. He was a good base stealer. Not only could run fast, but he could. He was a base stealer. And there's a difference between being fast and being a base runner, a stealer. You can be a little bit slower and still steal bases. You can be real fast and not steal bases. And George did have the knack of being a good base runner. You know what? When he was with Washington, he came in. You know, if he got on base, we just, you know, it's almost a sense to score, you know. George could run. He was fast. George could run. There's two people that I think compare them together. George Case and Louis Aparicio. Aparicio could be running full speed after the second step. George Case could do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Some of the rest of them would have to take four or five steps before they get into real. But on Aparicio's and George's second step, they went full.
When you were with the, you were just with the Pirates for a little time in 48?
Just a short time. I was only about, probably not more than 35 years.
Was Honus Wagner still coaching with the team then?
Yes, he was still coaching then. And I got the biggest kick out of him. Because about the sixth, seventh inning, he was sitting on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see him kind of edge towards the end of the bench.
Ready to go, huh?
He was gone. By the time the game was over, he was dressed and gone already. He was already in the bar. He was already probably his second or third bar on the way home. Yeah, but he was a fine old man. He was very funny, very likable. Very likable guy. Got his hands. Looked like a sack of walnuts or something.
Mm-hmm.
He just beat up.
All gnarled, huh?
All gnarled. He was kind of a character, and everybody loved him. They say he made a few bars on the way home. They say he never did buy himself a bottle of beer. He'd go into things, somebody would want to buy him a bottle of beer. He'd take a bottle here and then go on down, work his way home.
He never bought a drink?
Never bought a drink.
How about the guy you played with in Pittsburgh, Dixie Walker?
I didn't play with Dixie.
Was he... You were gone when he showed up?
I just knew Dixie from playing against him.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was with the Dodgers, I played against him some. But I didn't know Dixie. I didn't know his brother either very well. I mean, I knew him, but I just knew him.
Was Rip Sewell with the Pirates when you were there?
Rip Sewell. I played against him. He was, when I was with the Dodgers and Cardinals, he pitched against me. I hit against him. The funny thing about Rip Sewell, this story you've heard 1,000 times, it just so happened that I joined the Red Sox at the World Series, the All-Star game, and my wife and I had just got into town. We went to the ballpark to check in and everything, and the All-Star game was on, and just as we walked up in the ramp there, we saw this saw him throw this big loop to Ted Williams.
Aoife's pitch.
Ted hit it out. That's the last time I saw Ted. I thought that was pretty good.
Mm-hmm. How about the some of the guys from the Red Sox? I don't know if we talked about this last time or not, about the 46 series, the seventh game, about whether or not Johnny Pesky held the ball.
Yes, we talked about it. But Johnny Pesky, the ball was... Slaughter was on first base, and it was a hit and run play.
Right.
And Walker hit the ball just over, kind of left center over. So Pesky went out for the relay. And that time, of course, Slaughter was on second, was rounding second, and Mike Gonzalez was holding him up. Hold up. Well, he didn't pay attention to it. He ran ahead. And I blamed somebody else out there. I blamed probably somebody that didn't holler, he's going, he's doing it for a home. Well, Pesky just caught the ball and turned around, kind of dropped his arm just a little, just kind of relaxed. And then he saw he was going, and he threw ahead real quick. And the throw was off. Partee was the catcher. And the throw was off base just a little bit, and Partee couldn't catch the ball to get back quite in time.
Mm-hmm.
If the throw would have been good, if the throw would have been right at the plate, Slaughter would have been out probably 15 or 20 feet. But the throw was off, and the big play everybody talks about, of course.
Mm-hmm. How about Bobby Dorey? I know you played with him.
Yes, Bobby was, he was the reason I got to go with the Red Sox in the first place. I was managing Toledo for the Browns, and we were in fifth place in the American Association, and Bobby Dorr broke his finger, and at that time they were right in the middle of the
pennant race.
Yeah. So they was looking around for a second baseman, experienced second baseman that they could get. And so they came down to Toledo and bought me. And I went in and immediately filled in for him until he got, his finger got working. Okay. And then I became the utility man. And Bobby, I admired Bobby very much. He was a good pivot man also. Of course, he was built for that. He made himself a good hitter by playing in Boston with more of that short left field fence. Because he learned to hit every ball to left field. Mm-hmm. Normally, at other ballparks, he would probably been a different type of hitter. But he was a very excellent hitter in Fenway Park. He made himself that.
How about what did you think of Ted Williams when you finally started watching him on an everyday basis?
You know what? Ted Williams, I love Ted Williams. I love to watch him. I like to watch him hit, even when I was playing against him, you know, no matter where. But because he was a picture hitter. I mean, when he missed the ball, he looked good. And then I got to know him better. I got to know him much better after I got playing with him. We in the clubhouse with him and around him. And I say this, I don't think I ever heard another ball player criticize Ted Williams. And that's like, now, it's a different story. When a sports writer would come in, we'd be having a good time in the clubhouse, you know, getting ready to play when they got it. And get Ted to be the biggest clown among them. But let a sports writer walk through that door, and immediately, like this, Ted Williams' personality would change. Mm-hmm. He didn't like sports writers, no way, because they tried to make fun of him when he first came up, and they wrote things about him that wasn't true, that he didn't think was true, and it wasn't true. But Ted is, you like I said before, you not get anybody, there's no ball player I ever know of, ever said one bad word against Ted Williams. And I have seen Ted go to the ballpark and some of the opposing players would come over, hey Ted, I want to talk to you. You want to talk to him about hitting it. Ted would, you know, explain, you know, Ted, because he was a great student in the hit. And so Ted finally ended up and said, well, if you want to come out tomorrow, I'll come out with you at 10 o'clock. You get somebody to pitch to you, and I'll help you. And he did. And several times, I know, didn't have nothing else to do. If you want to park early today, I'll go out with you. I used to go out with him to opposing players, help opposing players hit. Not that I helped them, but I mean, I wanted to hear him explain the hitting to this other fellow. And he always did that. Another, I think if Ted Williams was walking down the street and somebody would say to him, hey Ted, how about you keep your elbow in or whatever, you know. He'd stop right then, no matter, perfect stranger, and start talking about hitting. He loved to talk about hitting. He's a great guy. He really is. He did a lot for that Boston club.
What was, you were there just for a short time, but why were the, why was the press always on his back?
Well, I think because when he first went there, one of the first things that happened, I think they told me that one of the reporters asked him. Of course, there was 12 or 14 papers that they had done. Each one of them wanted to scoop. Well, one fellow asked him about, something about that. And he said, oh, I like to chase firefighters. You know, he just said that. But I don't know. But anyway, he said, I like to watch. The firewire go down the street, he likes to run and see where the fire is. Well, they've made a big to-do of that, like he was a silly little kid, you know, chase firewire. And then they got on him because each one of them wanted a scoop. And if they didn't get a scoop, then they wrote some derogatory about him. And of course, he responded, naturally. And I think that's what it is. It's just that they got more out of him. They've gotten better stories out of him if they made him mad, made him say something. Mm. And so he blinds a lot of times too. But I think that there's a few, two or three sports writers he liked. I mean, if he come in, one of those sports writers that he liked, and he come in, he'd sit down and he'd really give him a good story and answer the question. You know. But some of the rest of them come around, and he really got on.
Do you ever, were you ever severely misquoted in the paper or anything like that?
Yes.
Yeah. How about when you're managing?
When I'm managing, I'd open up the paper several mornings and see where I was being quoted, and I hadn't even talked to the, you know, in fact, the manager probably wouldn't have, hadn't seen him for a week or something. And he'd come in, I'd be quoted. Yes, you get misquoted quite often. And also taken out of context a lot of times.